Hello, and welcome to Above Average Irrelevance. This is episode 18. Today is Monday, June 27th, 2016. I'm Matt Weaver, and I'm here with Scott Nelson. Good evening, Scott.
Hello.
It is a beautiful evening in Minnesota.
Yes.
We got the windows open. It's fantastic. If only all days in the summer could be this cool and sunny as they were today.
Agreed.
It'll never happen, though.
No, kind of been spoiled with some temperate weather lately.
Yeah. So we've had an irregular recording schedule lately because you and I apparently have lives that require us to do things other than record podcasts.
Right.
And I think that's going to continue for the next couple of weeks.
Indeed.
I mean, I'm going to be gone next week on the road, as it were, in the wind, actually. So, yeah, this podcast is going to have to tide our hordes of listeners over until we get back.
All right.
So
we'll just have all kinds of things to talk about next time then.
We can. I'm sure we will. I'm sure we'll have lots of things to complain about. In fact, just before we started recording, we were complaining about how relatively bad you and I are at doing window management on our macOS machines.
Yes.
Like, I'm always, you know, bringing some app to the foreground where I need to see some data in a window in an app in the background, and they're always on top of each other. And I have to spend lots of time moving the windows around so that I can see the foreground and see the background. I have a 27-inch iMac at home, and so being mobile on a 13-inch MacBook Pro is
a little less real estate.
A little less real estate, and I don't like it.
You know, that's part of the reason when we talked about Keynote stuff, why I was excited about that tabs feature.
Yeah.
Because I feel like I would use that to kind of compartmentalize windows and have an easier time finding what I'm looking for.
Yeah. It's a subtle skill, and I'm not great at it, apparently.
Speaking of which, it's interesting, post the WWDC keynote, have you, as more information comes out about features that they announced, there have been a few things that I've kind of gotten a little less excited about over time. And the key one is, did you know at the time they announced it, the web version of Apple Pay is Safari only?
That doesn't surprise me.
I never heard, it doesn't surprise me, but they never said anything about that. I never heard that announced. Well, that throws a huge wrench in the works as far as mass adoption across all platforms. I mean, they don't even support Safari on Windows anymore.
No, but it is supported on a billion iOS devices.
Well, it is. Okay. So mobile, maybe. I mean, but the idea was Apple Pay was going to work everywhere now in every browser window.
My guess, though, this is a statement in time, right? It's going to work on Safari initially because that's really the only thing that Apple has control over. And there's probably some standards, I don't know, I'm guessing here, but I'm assuming that there's some browser standards that they're going to need to be in place for that to be the case. And I'd be surprised if they're going to do it in a completely proprietary way that's only ever going to work in Safari.
We'll see. I know in the past, anytime you say, well, surely they're just starting off supporting it here and eventually it'll be supported everywhere, how often do you say that and it doesn't end up being the case with some Apple product? because they either change their mind or, you know.
Yeah, it's tough for me to know. The Apple does, they go their own way a lot. But I'm kind of immune from it because almost my entire universe
is Apple.
Lives in Apple.
Yeah. I think FaceTime was the last major one that, you know, it was going to be this open protocol. They were going to release the spec. It was going to be available everywhere. No, never happened.
I've almost gotten rid of all of my Android friends.
Well, that's the speculation now that they're getting into messages that they're going to, Apple Messages is going to be on Android one day. They actually did it with music. I didn't think it would ever happen. That was one where they said Apple Music is going to be on every platform. And I didn't think it actually would, but it's on Android. I don't know if anybody uses it on Android, but.
Yeah, I don't know. My guess is for mixed households, they use it.
There you go.
I am not an Apple Music customer, so I can't really comment on it. My guess is messages will only come to Android when there's a reason for it to go to Android. Lots of the internet suggests that messages is a big lock-in for why people are on iOS. I don't know if that's true or not. The cost of sending a text message is basically zero.
Right.
Almost everybody's cell phone plans, at least in America, include unlimited texting these days. So it used to not be the case. You know, Green Bubbles used to cost me a quarter, which I found frustrating. But there are also rumors that Apple is working on a money product somehow wrapped up with Apple Pay. Like, I could pay you money via a message using Apple Pay or back and forth again. And I know that there are other places in the world where texting money around is the way most people interact with any kind of financial institution at all. That will probably come to usums here in the developed world at some point.
I mean, there's a number of ways to do that now, and all of them suck.
Right. So, and that's true. All of them suck.
Right, but if I could just
text it to you,
you know,
then that'd be great. And that is probably something where the economic opportunity of that is big enough that somebody like Apple, A, wants to do it, and B, it's a reason to say, all right, it's now worth having this thing running on Android. Right. It wouldn't surprise me if they have it running on Android right now in the lab,
right?
Hidden away on some, you know, Android phones that nobody ever gets to see.
Well, anyhow, Apple Pay limited to Safari only makes it less interesting for now.
So I had speaking of Apple Pay, I had something weird happen to me over the weekend where it looked like maybe somebody had gotten a hold of my credit card number and was about to use it for nefarious things. Because I saw a $1 charge that I didn't do float past on my notification screen, you know, because it was the default card I use for Apple Pay.
Mm-hmm.
And so it pops up, and I'm like, I didn't do that. So I called my credit card company, and they, you know, launched a fraud investigation and canceled that number. And they're sending me a new card with a new number that should be here tomorrow. But in a matter of minutes, I had emails from my credit card company and from Apple saying, your old number has been turned off. You've been issued a new number. Apple Pay is ready to go.
Wow.
And it was. I mean, I used it a day later on Apple Pay. At McDonald's, of all places, because they're one of the few places here in the Midwest that takes Apple Pay.
Right. Cool.
One day the card will show up. Tomorrow the card will show up, maybe. And I can start the long and arduous process of changing over the gazillion things that just auto-charge on my card. Mm. I shake my fist. So, should we talk about this Pixar storytelling video?
Yeah, sure.
So it's a little 5-minute video that somebody made about the way Pixar tells stories that's different than everybody else. And it's because, you know, they work hard at story. And their animated movies take advantage of the medium You know, they do things that you can really only do in animated movies. Like, Toy Story only really works as an animated movie. So does Finding Nemo. Right? You can't really have any of those stories in some other medium. You know, like, could you make a play out of Finding Nemo? Probably not very well, right? So, I don't know. This is 5 minutes of brilliant YouTube-ness.
They do. It's interesting you say that. They do, or have tried to adapt basically all the Disney movies as live-action shows, musicals.
But none of the Pixars, though.
None of the Pixars. No, that is interesting. I think it's because Disney has a whole, like, they have a whole Broadway arm that develops things.
Well, the traditional Disney movies were something other than a movie before they were a Disney movie.
True.
Right? You know, Cinderella is an old story. Right?
Yeah.
It's been told in every medium possible.
Yeah, I found this to be very interesting. And they kind of bag on Disney a little bit, the traditional Disney storylines. And it's not, I mean, not that there's anything wrong with them, but there just isn't anything particularly interesting and educational. There's not a lot of character development. There's a lot of cliche relationships.
A lot of simple. In
Disney movies, yes.
Yeah. What it really comes down to is, you know, Pixar has traditionally had the freedom internally to say no, right? They've, you know, they've let some smart and creative people work in there, and they can get pretty far along working on a movie and say, man, it's just not, this doesn't make any sense. What are we doing here, right? And stop.
I remember hearing that. Did you hear there was a story about that with Inside Out? That, like, up until the very end, there were story problems, and they just weren't, you know, they were very reluctant and dragging their feet because it just didn't feel right. And then there was this, like, eureka moment where they identified how to tell the story, and then that.
Yep.
You know.
And that, I think that movie was in development for a long, long, long time.
And it's good they didn't rush it, because it turned out
great. It turned out great. I have to admit, when I saw the trailer for that, I'm like, oh, come on, this has got to be the one where they finally have messed it up.
Right.
But it really wasn't. Have you seen, I've heard that there's a cut on the internet somewhere that's just the parts not in the girl's head.
Oh, no.
Right. And if you watch just the parts in the real world, not inside her head, like, it's pretty dark.
Huh.
Right. Because, I mean, the mom and dad are arguing, and there's, like, a move, and she runs away. And,
true.
You know, in the context of the movie, it's just moments of intense sadness, right? Wrapped up around this story that's going on inside of her head and the emotions. But my girlfriend mentioned it to me, because she and I did not see this movie together. We saw it separately. And her comment was, you know, when you get done watching this movie, think about what happened to this girl, right? In the quote-unquote real world.
Right.
I'm like, yeah, you're kind of right. I mean, it's bad news, right?
So the other interesting thing about comparing Pixar to Disney is they're owned by Disney, right? Pixar was...
Now.
Right, they were bought by Disney. But I think it's still kind of operated as kind of like a wholly owned subsidiary.
Well...
I mean, Pixar seems to be pretty...
So it was, you know, John Lasseter and Ed Catmull... I think that I'm saying his name right. And I think there was, there was the Pixar Brain Trust, right? when Disney bought Pixar, the Pixar Brain Trust got the top jobs at Disney.
Gotcha.
Have you seen Finding Dory yet?
I haven't.
I haven't either. I'm going to go tomorrow.
It's interesting. You know, I have two interesting things that I have heard about that, though. Is number one, it falls into the whole everything is a remix category that we had talked about previously. I mean, it's essentially the same storyline as Finding Nemo, which I think is intentional. I mean, the title's the same. Like, you can't accuse them of surreptitiously stealing it. They obviously are making the same movie again. The other interesting thing is apparently now there's worry that this fish that Dory is, I can't remember what type of fish she is, but it's a fish that can't be...
Angelfish or something
like that? No, it's like a blue something or other. It's a fish that can't be bred in captivity. And so now there's this big worry that, you know, people are going to be out harvesting all of the wild.
Well, clownfish.
After Nemo, yeah. Exactly. Apparently that was a problem. So.
Yeah. The internet.
Now, if you search
for... blue tang.
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. A blue tang.
So, I don't know. We'll see. That might just be FUD. But...
blue tang fish. Blue tang fish for sale was a complete your search. Yeah.
Autocomplete is very telling.
It is.
Mm-hmm.
Especially when you type in a word and then it auto-completes with something that is totally not what you thought it was going to be, right? Like, how do I, and then it fills in remove a rat from my toilet or something, you know? I mean, it's, yeah. Yeah. Blue tang.
So I haven't seen it yet. I tend not to go see animated movies in theater because I don't like children. And there's
go to the Late Show.
Lots of children. Yeah. I don't always feel like watching an animated movie at 9 o'clock at night either. So usually I just rent them or Netflix them or whatever.
Aren't you all high and mighty? I can't watch Pixar at 9 o'clock at night. I mean, that's too late for Pixar.
No, it's just there's usually something else I'd rather go to a late show of, I guess.
Okay, then. But yeah. So
I'll put a link to this video in the notes. And it was really interesting, and I agree with most of what it was saying as far as what Pixar accomplishes in their movies.
I still am reminded, you know, a couple of weeks ago we talked about the how do you know when to make a cut when you're editing, and I think about that all the time now when I'm watching movies. And speaking of links, we'll drop in there. We can just talk about this, right? The music hits through the ages.
Oh yeah,
that website is pretty cool. It's basically all the top 40 hits in an interactive.
Right, so the timeline is just moving forward week to week, and it shows you the ranking of the hit chart, and as things move up and down, and then it plays little snippets from them.
Right.
You know, when I was watching that, first of all, it destroys the battery on my MacBook Pro.
Yeah, it does.
So I don't know what's going on in that. I mean, it wasn't Flash. I don't know if it was like some kind of, if it was SVG, if it was Vector or Canvas or what, but...
Well, it's doing a lot of computation, it's doing.
It used like half my battery, and I was probably playing with it for like, I don't know, 40 minutes or something. So it was a long time, but it's kind of crazy. I saw two really interesting patterns, and one of them is when a song is stuck at number one for a number of weeks, and you see people creep up and they get at number two and they sit there for 2 or 3 weeks and then they fall and they just can't overtake the number one. And it makes me feel bad when the number one song was something like I was back in the 90s and it was like Macarena. You know, it's at the top
something
of the charts.
Something that's not really aged well at all.
Right. And then some, you know, amazing song that came up to number two and then just couldn't break through. And it's like any other week, it would have been number one for sure, you know, but it just didn't make it happen because of this random, you know, pop hit.
And that's the thing I noticed is there was a lot of songs that were stuck at number one for multiple weeks that they're not bad songs, but they're not. They haven't really aged super well, right? They're just not stuff that, like, you hear it and you're like, oh, yeah, it's an old nostalgic song. But it's not a song
that
you'd listen to today. But a lot of stuff that made it to the top five, but maybe not number one, or was only number one for 1 week.
Right.
Is stuff that you still hear a lot today.
And the other pattern, you know, so you can watch the patterns as they're moving. And the other interesting pattern I found was when a song would go to number one and then it would drop down a couple of places and then it would go back up. And that happens very rarely. But there were several times I came across going through the 90s and 2000s where that happens. And that's kind of an interesting thing to think about when a song falls from number one but then resurges in popularity.
Well, yeah. I wonder how the patterns of how music became the most popular and became number one. I wonder if that still plays through to today. I think today there's more choice in music. And so, you know, I don't think top 40 radio is as powerful as it once was.
No.
And there's a lot more... I don't know if organic is the right term, but it's a lot harder for the music studios to declare these are the songs of summer, right?
Right.
I mean, they still have the songs for summer, but who cares, right? I mean, I get my music through so many different ways other than, you know, whatever Sony BMG is trying to shove down my throat, right?
Yeah, the initial rise to number one was interesting, too, because some of them, like... just shoot to number one, you know, it's not even in the top 10 and then all of a sudden it's at number one and then others just creep up, you know, one or two spots at a time until they get there. So it all depends on what else is out at the time too and what else was popular. So it was cool. I will undoubtedly spend more time just sitting watching it. It made me remember a time in my life when I actually listened to the top 40, like the Casey Kasem counts them down, you know. It was always so exciting to see what was gonna
be at the top.
Yeah, if someone was gonna get dethroned, or I feel like that is that even a thing anymore?
I
feel like it's not.
So I was traveling this past weekend, and in the car, it was in Wisconsin. And I just had the radio on, and it was literally a Casey Kasem, you know, top 40 countdown on the radio from like June whatever 1984. I mean, it was they were just playing
just
that on the radio,
replaying the countdown. Yeah. That's cool.
And it was Whitney Houston was the number one.
Huh.
Right. So. Okay.
So yes, they still do it, but it's the old episodes.
Yeah, it's still Casey Kasem.
Right.
Which, yeah.
He's got to be dead by now, right?
Oh yeah, he died. Yeah. So, yeah, we'll put the link to there because that was pretty cool.
Yep.
You want to talk about this Waze article?
Oh yeah, yeah. So this was an article about... So you're familiar with Waze. Do you use Waze?
No.
So it's the traffic app where people report road conditions, or I think it automatically reads some road conditions if you have the app running while you're driving.
Mm-hmm.
And then people can report like accidents or detours, construction, stuff like that. And then it automatically learns and adapts to advise other drivers based on, you know.
Right.
everybody's experience. So this, what this article was about is it was about Waze was essentially sending people through a quiet, you know, suburban street neighborhood because it was faster than going down the, you know, the main drag that traffic normally flows. And it was about these residents trying to fix the problem by getting on Waze and like reporting that there was heavy traffic on the street. And
right.
In this particular article, the regular road was undergoing some construction or was closed for construction. And there was a detour route that was marked. And these people did not live on the detour. But the detour obviously couldn't handle all the road flow. And so, you know, Waze was just routing people around. Right? It was the algorithm maximizing the throughput of cars on all available roadways, which is a noble and lofty goal and perfectly fine in the abstract. But what you get is, you know, I live on this quiet street that now has, you know, 1,000 times as many cars traveling on it in a given day than it used to. Right? I'm not okay with that. And that's, you know, I understand that. I mean, you live on a cul-de-sac.
Right. Right.
So, you know, the traffic on this street
is zero.
Is pretty much just the people who live here. The street I live on is in a subdivision. When I moved in, it was a dead end shortly farther down. But I knew when I bought it, they're going to keep building. And there will be more traffic. And they did, and there is. But it's just more traffic deeper into the neighborhood. Like, it's not, you know, they didn't, like, build a shopping center down the far end. And now there's, you know, 1,000 cars a day going past. Because I wouldn't have bought it then, right? Part of what you choose when you buy a house is how much traffic is there. And, you know, where do I think it's likely to change in the future? And so, wow. That's your,
just
your notification.
When you're ready for me to complain about something, I'll complain about that, but just let it go.
Yeah. I think Waze and apps like that have a certain responsibility to recognize, how much traffic they're diverting to roads that aren't really set up to accommodate it. Right. Like when I was coming home this weekend, I was on Interstate 39 and, the traffic was really bad. It was stop and go on a Sunday afternoon, which something had to be wrong. It was eventually stopped for so long. I mean, I know where I'm going. I don't have, you know, a mapping programming running, but I stopped for so long, I'm like, okay, well, let's turn on a mapping program. So I turned on Apple Maps and, you know, typed in my home address and said, route me home. And it's like, keep going down this road for, you know, 6 billion miles or however long it is. And so then we sit there in traffic for a while and I just waited. And eventually Siri or Apple Maps says to me, the road is closed ahead. You need to exit and take this alternate route. It's going to add 17 minutes. And it's like, ah, that would be why the traffic is so bad on this road, right? So I exited early. It was marked as an alternative Interstate 39 route, you know, detour. But I was way far, you know, it's 10 miles from where it was, where it suggested that the road closure was. But there was a sign on the side of the road that said, you know, how many minutes until you get to certain destinations. And, you know, it was suggesting like 59 minutes to get to a crossing highway that was like 12 miles up the road. Right. I mean, it's insane. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I went 1.8 miles to the next exit, exited off, essentially drove, you know, 8 or 9 miles, you know, off in one direction and then turned and drove 8 or 9 miles farther. And it got me around what the part that was closed and where the construction was, right? And it was, you know, 55 mile an hour, two lane highways, mm-hmm. but they're still highways, right?
Right.
And I had no problem driving on them. There's clearly a lot more traffic on this road than there normally was, mm-hmm. right? And you could see people that I assumed were locals because they were coming out of even smaller crossing roads, right? And they'd be like, wow, there's just like a lot of traffic. Mm. Why is there so much traffic on a Sunday afternoon? Well, it's, you know, all the people with smartphones diverting themselves
right.
off the interstate out and around. Mm. And that's one thing. But if it had started routing me through, you know, somebody's neighborhood, you know, that maybe would not have been the greatest thing, right? And then, you know, there's, in a commuting situation, people are already on edge because they're commuting and it's taking so much time. And so then they're in a neighborhood, you know.
Distracted, going too fast.
Distracted, right? They're slamming on the brakes, and, yeah. you know, foring it away from the stop signs and stuff like that, right? I mean, it feels like the apps that are choosing to route people around have to be better. They can't just use the default algorithm, which is I'm going to send as much traffic as possible on this road until it goes slower.
Right, and that's the point at which it will react, right?
Right.
Is
and
once
I just,
it has slowed down, then it will balance traffic back the other way.
Right, and I understand that we can do that with, you know, network connections and mm-hmm. and all kinds of other things in computer science, right? But when it comes to messing with people's lives in the real world and I'm putting their children at risk because I'm sending 1,000 times more traffic down a residential street than I should be doing, I feel like their algorithm has to be smarter and say...
There's just, I mean, where's that data come from, right? I mean, the map does not indicate which houses on the street have children present, so you can... you know, see like a child density in the neighborhood. I mean, that's not the way public infrastructure works. That's not a data point that's available.
So I disagree because Waze is owned by Google and Google probably has Google Street View of every street in America.
So they can tell by like the home type?
I believe that they have probably collected a lot of bits of data about, how much traffic flows on these roads. And certainly the departments of transportation for various places do traffic studies all the time and try to understand how much traffic is flowing on these roads and how big a road do we need to handle how much traffic there is. At the end of the day, I'm not saying that they shouldn't send anybody down these residential streets, but they can't just send as much as the street will handle until it backs up and use that as their feedback mechanism. That's fine for interstates and, you know, state highways.
Right.
It's not okay for residential streets, right? For residential streets, what they really need to do is say, you know, this street normally accommodates, I'm going to make up a number here, right? You know, 25 cars an hour. Right, I'm going to send an additional 25 cars an hour down the street. So a very few number of people running this app are going to be told to go this way. And I'm going to leave everybody else, you know, where they should be, right? And my contribution is going to be siphoning off small numbers of people onto, you know, shortcuts that are not really appropriate for them to be driving on because they're mm-hmm. commuting into the office, right? But is pulling away some traffic from where everything's jammed up to help everything move more smoothly.
There could be a happy medium there. Yeah.
I feel like there could be a happy medium there because I'm fairly certain, you know, I mean, where I live or, well, you're in the cul-de-sac, right? But if there was, you know, if one street over, it was closed and people had to come down my street and go around and come back again or something like that, right? Because it's something they were working on. Well, I know that for a few days there would just be increased traffic, right? Mm-hmm. If my street could be used as a shortcut, you know, from one thing to the other, and all of a sudden it was just slammed by traffic, well, that'd not be okay, right?
Yeah, I get it. That makes sense. I'm a little torn because I kind of have a problem with people who have a sense of entitlement to public infrastructure as if they own it and they can control it.
Yeah, you're absolutely correct.
Right? So have you ever been in a disagreement with somebody about parking, you know, in a limited parking situation, or, you know, people get this idea that the spaces on the street in front of their house are theirs and, you know, you shouldn't be parking your car in front of their house. And I had a buddy over here who used to, if he was running late for the bus, he would drive his car to the bus stop and then just take the bus to work. And one day he comes out off the bus and he has a note on his car from the people who own the house that was like, we don't want you parking your car in front of our house. It's a public street.
Yeah. I would park my car there every day. Then.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, and I've heard stories like this all the time, especially people who live in very dense neighborhoods where a lot of people park on the street. There's these arguments about ownership of parking places, and nobody owns the street that you live on. You do not own the street you live on.
No,
I'm sorry.
You don't. That said, you have some expectations about it, right? If you park your car in front of their house and then, you know, you come back late, 11:30 at night, and you get in the car and you start it up, and as opposed to driving away like a sane person, you roll down the windows, you crank your shitty music to as loud as your crappy stereo will go, and then do a burnout as you drive away.
Right. But then, I mean, there's other laws against that, right? There's noise ordinance and there's reckless driving and there's, I mean, there are laws that govern those kind of things. Even parking, like a lot of cities have laws that govern, like you can't park overnight, you know, on a street where you're not a resident or stuff like that. We don't really have a lot of that in our city here, but there are places that do have ordinances regarding where you can park and how long your vehicle can be parked. Mm-hmm. In one spot. So there's other laws that control that kind of thing. It's not me making a scene, you know, you can't do this on my street. So that's the one problem I have with it is, people thinking that they are in control of public infrastructure. But when it's a safety question,
but to some extent, you do have some say because your taxes pay for it too. And it's fair for you to say, somebody is abusing it, right? And it would be fair to say Waze is abusing my street, right? They're providing a service to their customers and they're doing so by abusing my street. That's not okay, right? I mean, why would
that? So we'll see what happens. I mean, maybe city government will get involved in these things and have some sort of lever which they can go to Google and say.
Well, if Google and Waze and all of the map providers are not dumb, they'll figure out how to algorithmically solve this problem because what they really don't want is for every city to start passing laws.
Right.
Right. Cause that complicates their lives beyond all reason. And there'll be so many court cases. I mean, you know, Google has a lot of money, but they could literally go out of business by all the court cases. Right. Like you can just imagine just an avalanche of angry people with pitchforks and lawyers, right? So
it'll be interesting. There's just going to be more and more of this.
There is,
as more of this stuff,
right? And we can talk about the woeful state of public transportation infrastructure in the United States, right? Which is a part of what's going on here.
Yeah.
And
there's been a lot of stories around Uber too. You know, how many more cars are on city streets now, people driving Ubers and causing more congestion.
Yeah, but the difference is, you know, like last time you and I went to Chicago, right? We Ubered everywhere. So we drove into town, we parked the car, sat in a parking deck for several days, and we Ubered everywhere. Right? So
it's car for car.
It's car for car, right? Yeah. And that Uber car probably picked up, you know, a dozen different people that day that weren't driving their car and weren't trying to park it at this restaurant or that museum or this beach or wherever, right? It was parked away in a parking deck, right? And you and I could go and see and do and eat and drink and not care. Ostensibly, Uber drivers are supposed to be knowledgeable in the area and sober, which were two things that we were not always the last time we were in Chicago, right? So that was a fundamental improvement and an enhancement to safety, in my estimation. Uber is trying to get rid of people, you know, drivers anyway, so.
Right.
Okay, well, speaking of cars.
Yes, I got an automatic. Which you can just, it's another thing to add on the list of things I've heard about on podcasts and then bought.
So, first, tell me what it is, because automatic can mean a lot of things.
Yeah, it is kind of an overloaded term. You know, there's that company Automatic that is like the people who make WordPress. And for a while, I kind of confused the two. So this is Automatic. It's a little device that you plug into your, I always say it wrong, OBD port.
Onboard diagnostics.
Yes, OBD. You plug it into your OBD port in your car, and it monitors what's going on with your computer.
So that onboard diagnostic port is a government mandated port that has to be on all cars sold in the United States. Yep. And has been since 1996. And there's a bunch of bits of information that the computer in your car spits out and shoves onto that port. And the automatic is smart enough to interpret these things.
So any time you take your car into the shop and they say, we're going to hook it up to the computer, they're plugging into this port. When they say, we're going to read the codes, they're plugging it into this port and retrieving that information. So the main reason, one of the main reasons I got it is I have a check engine light that comes on periodically, but there's not really anything wrong. And I've had it looked at it before and they've told me what the codes are and I just never really pay much attention. But it kind of had me curious. And now, sure enough, when the check engine light comes on, it pops up on my phone and it tells me what the code is. And there's an explanation of what's going on and you can do a search on it and stuff.
So this thing is Bluetooth to your phone?
Bluetooth to the phone.
Not Wi-Fi?
No.
That'll be important later.
Okay.
The next thing we're going to talk about, I'm going to complain about this.
Okay, so it is Bluetooth to the phone. The other thing it does that's pretty cool, so its main the main feature, aside from the diagnostic stuff, is it's monitoring a few data points to give you a driving score of like how good, how efficient a driver you are.
Right.
The three things that it monitors right now, I'm assuming that, you know, this is going to improve. They'll monitor more and more things over time. But right now it's hard stops, fast accelerations, and minutes at which you travel over 70 miles per hour. I feel like that third one is kind of bogus and it irritates me. Like right now I actually have a very bad score because most of the driving I've done recently was on a highway that had a 70 mile per hour speed limit.
Oh yeah.
So I was going, you know, I usually set my cruise at, I don't know, 72, 73, something like that. So it's like the whole trip was a low score for my fuel efficiency and driving because I'm traveling over 70 miles an hour.
Yeah.
Is that a real thing? Is that like an arbitrary number they've picked, or is 70 miles per hour the point at which you're
No, it's a. I think that's arbitrary because I think it depends on every car, right? Yeah. The characteristics of every car relating to its gearing in the transmission and the power output of its engine, and the aerodynamics of the car. So every car will be more or less efficient. Now, it is basically true that the faster you go, the more power it takes, and it's a non-linear thing.
Mm-hmm.
So
there is like a point at which you should not cross this threshold if you want your maximum fuel efficiency. Well, I just don't know necessarily for my car if that's 70 miles an hour.
Yeah, but I'm sure, you know, if you set your cruise at 70 and drive for a while and measure your fuel economy, and then you set your cruise at 65 and measure your fuel economy, undoubtedly you get better fuel economy at 65.
Yeah.
And if you go 60, you get better fuel economy again.
Hmm.
Right. Now that you have an automatic, you could probably
Start science. Experimenting. That's the other cool thing. So when you're done, I mean, it tells you for every given trip, you know, you can look and see what statistics about the trip. It'll tell you an actual dollar value of what the gas cost for that trip. Mm. Which is kind of fun sometimes, you know, you go...
So just plug into Gas Buddy or whatever and
say... Yeah, you know, lots of times I say, oh, well, it would cost more than that in gas just for me to drive there and back or whatever. Well, now I can see, okay, that trip cost me exactly $6.75.
In gas.
Yeah, so I think that's really cool. The thing that I actually really like, too, is it tells you very accurately how much gas is left or how many miles you can go on the remaining gas.
This is really important to you.
It is, because I don't like to get gas until I absolutely have to. And, you know, I've known when my gas light comes on, I usually have around 40, 45 miles before I'll actually run out of gas. Well, now I get a notification on my iPhone that says... You have exactly 23 miles before you run out of gas. So I don't know how accurate it is, but it's much more accurate than the fuel gauge, obviously.
It's probably as accurate as...
Like past driving history, essentially.
Well, it's as accurate as the fuel gauge is.
Yeah, but what's being reported through this diagnostic port is much... more precise than the needle.
I'm not talking about the needle. What I'm saying is whatever fuel gauge system your car uses, whether it actually has a float in the tank,
it depends on how accurate that is.
Right. If that thing is reading the exact amount of fuel that's in the tank, then you probably get a very accurate number. If when that thing reads zero fuel left in the tank, but there's actually, I don't know, a quarter liter of gas in the tank, then your range will actually be a little longer than what it says. But if when that thing reads that you've got, you know, a quarter liter of fuel left in the tank, but the tank is actually dry, then you're in trouble.
Yeah.
Right. So now you're stuck on the side of the road, right?
I think we had talked about this before. Like, I'm really interested... I want to know how accurate it is. So I feel like I'm going to have to run out of gas sometime just to see how accurate the automatic is.
So as long as you...
So then I know for future reference, how far can I push it?
Just stop and get gas.
Oh, man. But so far, I think it's really fun. I used a discount code when I bought it. It was like $80. I don't know if I've gotten $80 worth of value out of it yet, but I am enjoying it. I'm having fun with it.
You've talked about it more than once.
So I know.
The storytelling value of it alone has got to be approaching $80.
The other thing that's interesting is it has an audible sound, which you can disable, but I left it on, and it makes kind of like a little chirping noise when you do bad things. So like when I do a hard stop, I'm like, oh, no, you know, and it like when I cross 70 miles per hour, it goes, you know, so it like it's giving you real-time feedback. To shape it up, you know?
It would not like me. Sometimes, not all the time. Sometimes I view the roads as my own personal racetrack. I'm not often going, you know, 1,000 miles an hour down the roads, but I'm often performing maximum acceleration and maximum cornering.
Automatic would scold you nonstop. But, so the other thing that's cool about this is it has an API. It has all this integration stuff you can do. Like it has IFTTT support. So when you're driving in a particular place or doing a particular thing, you can, I don't know, interact with other
What would you do devices. With IFTTT with it?
I haven't really dug into it yet. That's what our mutual friend, who is also who I, you know, we were corresponding with, who's also getting one of these, was really into interested in programming it. I can't remember. I think he had a use case that he wanted to program it to do, but I can't remember. I mean, the Internet of Things answers are, you know, when you're getting close to your house, it can
turn on,
open your garage door or whatever. I don't know, stuff like that. But
yeah, most of the Internet of Things things are, you know, I guess I could add 1,000 layers of complication to do something that I can just walk over and turn the switch on for, but okay.
I'm probably only really interested in getting the data using the API. So like if I wanted to pull down and see my monthly driving cost average or something, or how much did I spend on gas last year, or I could see using the API just to get at the data and play with it. I don't know about integrating with other services.
One of the more clever things I think would be helping me remember you got that errand to run and you're really close to that thing, you know, because you're over here anyway. Like here I'm over at Scott's house and you remember you've got to run that errand to the grocery store, which is, you know,
yeah, like a 500 feet away notification thing,
right?
That'd be cool,
or something along those lines, yeah. Right, that would be pretty clever. I don't know that IFTTT is the right answer for that, but
it has great support too for if you need mileage for like business purposes.
Yep.
Because it, I mean, it's built in trip logging essentially.
Yeah. Is there GPS in it? Don't know.
There is. Because
is it just
you don't have to have your phone on you in order to have the trip mapped. So okay. It must have GPS in it. That's the thing. It's not telling you things on your phone while you're driving. And I think that's a safety feature.
Yeah.
When you shut off the ignition, then the trip updates on your phone.
I'm curious if there's a, if there's an Apple CarPlay version of the app.
I don't know.
That'd be an interesting thing.
So yeah, so far I don't regret purchasing it. It's fun. And it's not something you have to, I mean, it's just going to stay plugged into that port. I might not pay attention to it for a month, but it's there recording the data. You know, it doesn't hurt anything.
Yeah, I would, sometime when we take a trip together somewhere, we either have to take your car or we should plug your automatic into my car. I'm really curious about it.
Yeah. Oh, the complaint though. Can I complain?
Yeah.
The terrible experience is when you get it, you have to go plug it in.
Yeah.
And you hook it up to your phone. You have to create an account and do all this stuff. It immediately needs to update the firmware. And so I had to sit there and I was afraid to set my phone down and leave it because I was afraid if the phone like went to sleep, what happens if it's in the middle of updating the firmware. I'm always worried about this. Like when I'm updating the firmware on a watch through my phone or something like that.
Yep.
I feel like I need to attend to it until it's done. It took like, I don't know, it was 15 or 20 minutes and I'm sitting there like sweating in the hot car because you can't turn the car on.
Why does it have to be plugged in?
I don't know. It had to be plugged in. Oh, because it gets power from the OBD port. So the device has to be plugged into the car in order to do the firmware update. It was a bad, like, right out of the box experience, but
they need, like, a power it off a USB and update the firmware in the
air-conditioned house. Yeah. Well, and then our friend who got one, he was in a parking garage or something and you have to have cellular service to download the firmware update to load on the device. So he had to like move his car to where he had cell service. So that's not really a super experience, but I'm assuming that I'll never have to update it again. So
or infrequently.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So anyway, automatic. It's pretty cool.
All right. So I got a GoPro. I know everybody else has a GoPro, but now I have a GoPro.
That's so 2012.
I know. So I bought a GoPro session because I'm going to take a motorcycle trip and I want to create a time-lapse video from everywhere I go on the trip. So the GoPro session is going to do that for me. I have 6 64 gigabyte micro SD cards.
Is that what you estimated it's going to take to do the whole trip? Is that the deal?
Yes. Now that I have the thing and I've been doing some testing about how many images do I need to capture per second or how many seconds between images, I'm going to need 6 cards. And they're basically going to be full. And I could, if I was willing to spend even more money on cards, I should probably be capturing at a higher rate than I am anyway. But
is 64 gig the max that it'll accept, or is that just the best bang for your buck?
It is the best money per gigabyte option today in the market, barring some crazy sale you might find. But GoPro contradicts themselves about what capacity their cameras will accept. The manual, like if you download the PDF of the user manual for this thing, it says it accepts 64 gigabyte cards. If you look on GoPro's webpage about which micro SD cards should you be using in your GoPro, they claim that this Hero Session will support 128 gigabyte card. I do not have any 128 gigabyte cards. A friend of mine has one. We jammed it in the Hero Session to see what would happen, and the Hero Session crashed. I had to force power it off and power it on again to make it work. But that was before I applied the latest firmware update to the session. I don't know. Right?
64 it is.
So 64 will be enough. There won't be any days where at least a 64 gigabyte card won't be enough for that day. There's one day we're going to be on the tail of the dragon. I intend to capture images at 1 image per second for the bulk of that day. And that'll basically fill up a whole card. I'm choosing to go 5 megapixel as opposed to 8 megapixel. I would like the wider field of view that the 8 megapixel will give you. I can't afford the space, right? With the 5 megapixel images, you're looking at, 28,000 images that you can capture, more or less. I have one card that is going to capture less because I shoved it in the GoPro. I got it and I tested it. I shoved it in the GoPro. I formatted the card in the GoPro. I took a few pictures with it, took a little video with it. Seemed to work okay. I formatted it again. And it was like, wrong. Now I have no SD card in me. It was like, yeah, you do. My Mac couldn't read it. It appeared to be dead. But I downloaded, this was a Lexar card. And Lexar's webpage says, you should format it using this tool. And it was some SD
disk imager,
SD format. SD format from the SD Card Association.
Yeah.
And I made that thing do a full overwrite format. And now it appears to work again. But the GoPro estimates that it'll hold fewer images now than the other cards. So I assume there was some chunk of was bad, and that's now been marked off and worked around. That's okay. What I assume.
Interesting.
So I'm going to use that card on one of my lighter days of image capture, and it's going to be for some less interesting interstate driving portions.
Gotcha. So you're not going to do any video. It's all image capture.
Yes.
Okay. And you have it all mapped out, the rates that you're going to do for each leg of the trip. And
yep.
Cool. So what's the ultimate goal with all this footage?
I would like to eventually, at the very least, I will turn what I've captured into a time-lapse movie for every day. If I'm super ambitious, I'll turn that then into a single movie of the whole trip, which will include some time-lapse video from where we went, plus interspersed some pictures of
titles and
of things that we see along the way, right? Pictures that I take and other people take. So, I don't know. We'll see.
It's just an experiment.
Yeah. You know, because I thought, SD cards are cheap. GoPros are cheap. Yeah. Well, 64 gigabyte cards. I've almost approached the cost of the GoPro. I mean, the GoPro is $200.
Yeah.
I think I've spent $160 now buying SD cards. And I'm going to have acquired, when I'm all said and done, like 350 gigabytes worth of images. And close to, I don't know, probably 300,000 plus or minus images.
Hmm. So then you're going to have to store those somewhere forever.
Well, I'm not...
The lifetime expense of this is getting higher and higher.
I'm not so worried about that. I'll definitely need some big working space in order to mash all this crap together. And then, ultimately, my iMac is going to have to burn CPU for days and days and days to process all this stuff.
Huh.
The scale of it is just big enough that it'll be a thing. Like, I've made time-lapse videos before, and it's one thing to take a camera and point it at the sky and take, one picture every 30 seconds and see a 2-minute time-lapse of 4 hours of clouds rolling by. I mean, that's kind of cool, right? It's another thing to capture more or less 10 to 12 hours of time-lapse video, of time-lapse images a day for 11 days.
Right.
And then process all that down into something, right? I don't know. We'll see.
So are you mounting, is the camera mounted on the bike or on your helmet?
Bike.
Okay. Did it come with some kind of a standard mount, or did you buy a specific mount?
The bike I'm going to use and I'm going to ride, one of the GoPro sticky mounts, I think will work really well. I'm just literally going to stick it on the front fairing of the bike, and it's just going to be out there. I'm probably going to need to take a cloth or something, because it's...
and get splattered.
It's going to get splattered, right? At every gas stop, I'm going to have to clean the lens off, right?
Oh, yeah.
We'll see. Hopefully the GoPro makes it 11 days, right? Don't know. We'll find out.
It's just like a little thing, isn't it?
Yeah,
just like...
it's a little like inch and a quarter cube. It's a little black cube.
If it gets hit with some big, like a June bug or something, it might knock it right off.
I doubt that. It could get hit with a rock.
Yeah.
Or God knows what could come flying off of something in front of
it. But you can't really put it in a case or anything because, I mean, that's going to...
Well, I got the session because you don't have to put it in a case. Okay. Like, it's waterproof, air quotes, waterproof without a case.
Okay.
That's its claim to fame, right? The other GoPros are a little bit bigger and fancier. But in order to get any waterproofness, they got to be in a case. But I need to power this thing off the bike.
Right.
So my plan is, when it's not raining, this thing will just be plugged into the bike, right? The USB will be sticking out the side, and that'll be plugged into the 12-volt outlet on the bike. And it'll be running off of that. And then when it rains, I'll unplug that, click the door shut, and now it's theoretically waterproof. And
how much battery does it have?
With Wi-Fi on, shooting high-definition video, they claim an hour and 45 minutes. Taking time-lapse images? Don't know. GoPro doesn't say. it'll be a couple hours. The odds that we're going to be in rain for more than a couple hours are low. And if we are, then the battery runs out and, hey, it happens, right? What can you do? So, yeah, we'll see.
Cool. Sounds fun.
So now my complaint about Wi-Fi.
Okay.
Right. So the GoPro has an app for your phone that you can use to monitor settings, you know, change settings on your GoPro, right? And regular GoPros have a screen and buttons, right? The GoPro Session has a little tiny screen and two buttons, right? So you can click through using the buttons, but it's kind of clunky, right? The app is much nicer for changing settings and doing stuff, right? If I recall, I had to Bluetooth the Session to my phone. And then, but the Session has its own built-in Wi-Fi in there. And so when you want to control it, you got to connect your phone to the Wi-Fi on the Bluetooth, on the Session. Like, you got to go into settings, choose the Wi-Fi on the GoPro.
So it's like an ad hoc Wi-Fi network.
Yeah, that you want to connect to. And then you can launch the GoPro app and control it.
Why can't it just do that over Bluetooth?
Don't know. Now, it does send back a bunch of data. Like, you get preview of what the thing is looking at. And when you're recording video, you can see on your phone what it's recording.
It's just too much to do over Bluetooth.
But I don't want any of that.
Yeah.
Hey, idiots.
It's too bad it won't let you do configuration over Bluetooth and then anything.
And control, right? Like, start recording. Stop recording.
Yeah.
Change your settings, right? I want to do that over Bluetooth.
That's unfortunate. Yeah.
Right? And Bluetooth 4.0 even includes a Wi-Fi section. I think you could do this whole thing over Bluetooth. Right? Having to actually go into settings on my phone and tell the Wi-Fi to connect to the GoPro Session is infuriatingly bad.
It's because all that software was written a few years ago when you couldn't do it over Bluetooth.
They should throw it away.
Yeah.
It's crap.
That's my guess.
It's bad. Like, it
is that, you know, at the time that they did it, it was something that was unique and original, and they fixed the problem by establishing a Wi-Fi network, you know. Well, it's just, it's not the right thing anymore.
No, they need to fix it. If they're going to charge the money they charge for this crap, they should friggin' fix it.
Did you do any research on cameras? You know, I know GoPro was kind of a thing, and now it's faded a little bit in popularity. Did you look at other camera options? Was this still your best bet?
I did look around a little bit. You know, Sony makes some stuff. And at the end of the day, what it comes down to is the GoPro ecosystem is probably the largest. So in terms of available mounting hardware and all that other stuff, GoPro is probably the biggest. So, I felt like, since I wasn't exactly sure what I was getting myself into, this was the place to start. Like,
nobody ever got fired for buying a GoPro.
Well, somebody should get fired for their software. I think if I had a very specific use case, or I was going to do this again and I knew exactly what my requirements were going to be, I could see finding a different camera that was you know, it was the minimum I needed for what I was, the specific thing I was going to do.
Right.
Like, you know, I know a bunch of guys that have their, you know, like Porsche 944 race cars, right? And they're doing track days and stuff like that. And so a lot of people, when they do that sort of stuff, they've got a camera in the car, you know, like on their, somewhere in the car, pointing out the windshield so they can see what the driver is doing and out the window, right? In that sort of case, you maybe don't need a GoPro, right? I know a lot of guys have moved from the GoPros, which are not the cheapest things that money can buy, and started buying other lesser cameras. But they know it's in a car. It's not going to get
right. Wet. I don't have to worry about weather.
You know, and it's got to work for, you know, 30 minutes per session or something like that, right? I mean, it's not... They know their specific use cases, and they can find something cheaper that works just as well or better. Hmm. And that's fine. But not knowing exactly what I was getting into, I thought I'll just start with the GoPro and go from there.
Gotcha. Cool.
It's neat, but I wish their software was less stupid.
Yeah, that is dumb.
Yeah. All right. What else you got? Anything?
That's it. That's my only new toy. So.
Yeah. The cat has decided we should be done recording this. So.
Yep, he needs some entertainment, and he does not listen to podcasts.
His loss. Until next time.
See ya.